Welcome to the American College of Foot and Ankle Surgeons podcast, volume 3, number 2, for February 2009.
My name is Barry Rosenblum. I'm from Boston, Massachusetts, and today we are honored to have a dialogue with Dr. Lowell Weil. First, I'd like our participants to introduce themselves.
Jim Thomas from West Virginia University.
Jared Kane, Park Ridge, Illinois.
Well, I'll get the dialogue started. Dr. Weil, we've seen your practice of podiatric surgery and foot and ankle surgery evolve over the years. What are some of the observations that you've seen and made that sort of allowed you to adapt to the times?
Well, it's been a pretty remarkable career from the standpoint of when I began in 1965. I had my residency in 1964, and I had a 6 months residency at Civic Hospital in Detroit, Michigan. And when we think back, to think that I was able to even practice podiatric medicine with a six-month residency, that just blows my mind. With today, the type of training that's available, with a standard to have at least three-year residency program, and then those that continue on with fellowships and so forth, is what the almost the bare minimum is necessary to be an accomplished foot and ankle surgeon and be able to present yourself to the public as being knowledgeable and experienced. We had to learn it on our own back in those days as much as possible and tread very slowly, operating out of our offices and under great criticism, must I say, by orthopedics that we would dare operate in the office setting, whereas, of course, now we know today that outpatient surgery is done 55% of the time and inpatient surgery only 45% of the time. So it's made a complete turnaround, and podiatry was pretty much on the ball way back then. Much of my education I garnered through close relationships with my colleagues in podiatry. I visited as many as I possibly could back in those days and visited their offices, watched how they worked in practice as well as how they treated their patients and in the operating room as well, and tried to gain additional experience and maturity back in those days of just evolving very, very slowly. I then went into private practice by myself. I did not have a nurse, could not afford an assistant until I was in practice for about 7 or 8 months. And then I finally had my first assistant and then continued on. After about a year and a half of practice, I joined with Steve Smith, who is currently from California. Steve was a very close friend of mine throughout school. He took the same residency that I did. And together we pushed each other very, very hard as far as who could get the most knowledge, who could read the most scientific papers out there and be on the ball. So it was a great, fun relationship that lasted for 20 years until Steve moved back to California. But during that time, probably one of the great hallmarks of our career was that we decided we were going to attend the Academy of Orthopedic Surgery meeting. And back in those days, podiatry was really not very well accepted to come to any orthopedic meetings or be involved in any way. And we actually had to sneak into the meeting. We could not register on our own. My brother-in-law was in academic medicine, and he gave me his credentials to use. And Steve borrowed credentials from someone else. So we went under fictitious names during the lectures. It was the second year of the American Orthopedic Foot and Ankle Society. We actually had to hide up in the projection booth. We paid off the projectionist so we could hide up there and tape record the meetings and listen to the meetings going on. And that was the beginning of our attending the Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, which we continued to attend. And I have attended. I think I missed 1 year in the last 30 years or so. That's been a great inspiration for us, and we took many of those lessons of how to run meetings, how to deal with vendors, with industry, and try to impart that into the podiatric medical profession as well. And I think it was quite successful with the ethical aspects of it, and just taking lessons from people who had been around 150 years to those of us in podiatry. Perhaps the profession was only 50 years old or so when I entered it. So the big evolvement that we've seen through this is that we are now, podiatry and podiatric surgery is now on par with the field of orthopedics, certainly in the field of holding meetings and the like.
You know, let me jump ahead. You mentioned the relationship with orthopedic surgeons and the fact that you attended their meetings early on. You seem to have made quite the change as far as a career is concerned, from having to sneak into those meetings to now being what I see from the literature, being somebody who's sought after at those meetings. How did that happen? How did you go from being a podiatrist who sat in the projectionist booth to someone who is now welcome at not only national but international meetings with orthopedic surgeons?
Well, I was never one who could go out and knock on doors to introduce myself and tell people I'm here, I'm a great guy, and please send patients to me. I was really a bit shy in that area. And I think the successful part of what I did there was really to give of myself, to show up at a meeting, not say anything, be polite, especially at international meetings. I submitted a paper to an international meeting. My first one was in Austria, Vienna, Austria. I just by chance, I decided to give it a shot, and I submitted a paper there, and it got accepted. Well, they had many social activities that were going on, and I never hid the fact that I was a podiatrist to everyone around there. So I was kind of a unique person. I had a wonderful wife, which I still do, who was always very engaging, and I think the guys would talk to me because they wanted to talk to her at the same time, perhaps. But nevertheless, just kept quiet, kept low-key, never pushed myself, never asked the questions that I knew the answers to on board, and just kind of hung around. And before long, I started to make friends in the international community, as well as showing up at the local meetings, the academy meetings here in the United States. And when my friends from Europe would come around, they were well sought after as well. They would hang out with me, and some of the local orthopods would start to make friends with us as well. And that's how it all started, but just by kind of laying back and doing it slowly and not trying to force myself upon them. And I think in this way, we were able to engage in meaningful conversation, and slowly barriers broke down in that way. Probably one of my biggest successes and efforts were just by chance when I met a French orthopedic foot and ankle specialist by the name of Samuel Baruch many years ago, and he gave a talk just before I gave a talk, and then I gave a talk on doing actually a scarf bunionectomy. And soon thereafter, one of his friends came up to me and said he'd like to have lunch with you, but he doesn't speak English. So this gentleman translated for him throughout, and within a month he wrote me a note that he wanted to come visit me in Chicago. But yet he spoke no English. But fortunately, my daughter, who was in high school at the time, was a French major, and she translated for us. He stayed at my house, and we became dear friends. We're able to communicate that week, and together we perfected, as close as you can get perfected, of the scarf bunionectomy, and we would he'd operate at my institution. I'd go to France, operate there, and we worked on it, and he gave me the introduction to the European community, and they named the Weil osteotomy, which really was an osteotomy that was taught to me by Barry Johnson of Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And I made a couple of little modifications, but it came out to be the Weil osteotomy, whereas it should have been the Johnson, and in small letters, Weil osteotomy. But it was what it was. And the next thing I knew, I came to an American meeting, and Jim Simarco, who is a past president of the American Orthopedic Foot and Ankle Society, came up to me and he said, what the hell is this Weil osteotomy? I said, what do you mean? I said, what is it? He says, yeah, they're talking about it in Europe. I said, well, draw a picture for me. And he drew the picture, and I said, well, that's just an oblique osteotomy. And he says, well, they're talking all about it in Europe all the time. So that's how that came about by chance, and it kind of gave me some recognition, probably not deserved, but some recognition in the European community. And eventually I became closer and closer with orthopedic surgeons who I liked and got along with well, and started actually traveling with them socially. Some of them have become my closest friends, as have many podiatrists as well. And just by being around, hanging around, keeping quiet, and just letting it all happen rather than forcing it, which I see so much today. Everyone wants instant gratification and wants to be recognized immediately, and it's just not the way it works in business, or whether in professions. You have to earn the respect, and I think I did that very slowly, but perhaps successfully.
Dr. Weil, during your tenure as president of ACFAS, a lot of great strides were made, a lot of things were accomplished. What were some of the challenges that you had to deal with when you were president of American College of Foot and Ankle Surgeons?
Well, when I first finished my residency, all of my mentors were very active in the American College of Foot and Ankle Surgeons, so it was only natural that that's something that I wanted to pursue and I would pursue and become an associate as quickly as possible and a fellow as quickly as possible and join committees and so forth. But then the college ran into a little bit of a dull period of time where the big meetings were not the American College of Foot and Ankle Surgeons, but rather the Hershey meeting and the North Lake meeting, and it kind of fell off. And the American College of Foot and Ankle Surgeons became a travel club, and I started having less interest in that organization. I went to one meeting in Miami, and I saw an audience. There was only 25 people sitting for one of the speakers in the audience, and I thought, that's terrible. That's just awful that that would happen, and it was more of a come have a good time and very little education. So I kind of voiced my feelings in a letter to the college at that time that I wanted to see better and better, and put my foot in my mouth, because the next year I got a call from Jim Lawton, who was the president-elect, and he asked if I would be scientific chairman for the next meeting. And I did take that on, and it was a meeting held in New Orleans. And I used all of my experience of having been to meetings around the world in running that meeting and doing a combination of abstract lectures, good scientific talks, 6 minutes each, and inviting everyone around, opening it up to the rank and file as well as the seasoned veterans as well, and combining the two. And we had an overwhelming audience. We sold out. We had more people than we had seats in the auditorium. And that was kind of my entrance again into the American College of Foot and Ankle Surgeons, and that continued on for another year, and then I was invited to join the board. And we had some great years then. I think that the people before me, Arnie Cohn and certainly Alan Shaw. Alan Shaw was a great contributor during his tenure with practice guidelines. Alan virtually took that whole job on himself and really came up with some great strides. We also looked at our leadership from the standpoint of administrative leadership, and John Bennett, who was a wonderful guy and a great contributor to the growth of the American College of Foot and Ankle Surgeons and certainly the American Board of Podiatric Surgery. And I worked with John when I was president of that organization. And we found that the times had changed and we needed to go beyond just a two-man group running the association. We needed to think very strongly about moving our office to a central area in the United States. So I was probably one of the ones who pushed us getting a new executive director as well as moving our office to Chicago. That combination came at the same time. So we wanted to make it as soft as possible on John, and we said we're moving to Chicago. And, of course, we knew John wouldn't leave San Francisco, so that was an easy time for us to get a new executive director, and that was a big, I think, a big thrust in the organization. Of course, one thing that we decided, we were also going to start doing our own lobbying instead of APMA. We were going to be independent. We had a very rude awakening. When I did become president, one of my responsibilities was to lobby in Washington on behalf of the college. And our executive director at the time had experience in that area, so she scheduled all these wonderful meetings with senators and with congressmen who fell asleep at every one of my little presentations, my three-minute presentations. Their heads were bobbing up and down. You know, thank you very much. You know, put the check on our desk and everything will be fine. So it was a rude awakening that this is not an easy task and that the American Podiatric Medical Association was far and beyond experienced in this particular level of necessity for the podiatric profession, and we really had no business in it at that time, and we're just wasting our money. So we quickly backtracked and got out of that business. But what we did really work hard on is trying to have better educational meetings, evidence-based meetings in combination with abstracts and anecdotal reports, and trying to engage in better ways. And we invited orthopedic surgeons, and through my contacts in that particular area, I was able to bring orthopedic speakers to our meetings, which helped us. But at the same time, it helped them learn about us. They came to the meetings and they were amazed at the level of our talks, at the level of our understanding of foot and ankle surgery, especially forefoot surgery. And they went back and talked to their people about it. So it gave a level of respect. What was so interesting is you always got the most respect from past presidents who were out of the political world, but those on the way up had to be very careful, as they still do, in trying to be too close with us because they represent a different organization. So these are the challenges before us today, I think, of how we can align in a meaningful way, but at the same time out of a respectful way, that we are different professions, but we have common goals, and that's what I believe we need to work toward.
Dr. Weil, you've been exceedingly active in the area of sports medicine, both in the care of NFL players as well as Major League Baseball, and I think we'd be very interested in trying to understand maybe how that evolutionized for you and how you got involved with that in particular. And as someone myself who just has undertaken the care of a Division I team, you know, there's a lot of sports medicine that is, especially in surgery, is very similar to, you know, to the non-sports medicine population. But there are certainly some very unique situations there, too. And I'd like to get your understanding or maybe have you discuss any of those types of situations also.
Sure. The field of sports medicine is a unique field because, as you say, the challenges are very similar with regard to the pathology that we see. The difference is we have well-conditioned athletes, dancers, ballet stars. Ballet dancers I considered as athletes as well. In fact, a paper I gave at the APMA meeting several years ago, and I can't remember the date. I only remember it was the same year that Elvis Presley died, because he died the day before I gave the paper. And it was on injuries in ballet dancers and professional football players, who heals faster. And the summary of that particular talk happened to be the ballet dancers with similar injuries to the football players got better faster than the football players. And the reason being is that if the ballet dancers stayed out for a month, they lost the job. There was no turning around. Somebody replaced them, and they were finished, where football players had the leisure of coming back a little more slowly. But I think the challenges, especially in professional sports, and I got into it by chance, we saw a patient who was an ex-Chicago Bear player, took care of his daughter, actually, and he just thought it was really neat the way our office was and so forth. And he introduced us to the trainer of the Bears, who invited me out to visit their training facility at the beginning of the year, starting practice. So it was in the summertime. And again, we went out there, Steve Smith and I went out there together, and we just stood there. We watched and we watched. And if somebody hurt themselves, we didn't go running over and push everybody away. We just stood there until someone asked us to take a look at them. That was always the attitude that we had. Wait until you're called upon. And then we're called upon, we'd give a answer, never charge for services when we were out on the field. And I did the same thing when I volunteered to work with dance companies. I was interested in dance, and I wanted to find out more about dance. So I went in there, and I photographed dancers, looked at all the different things. Just because I happened to be there, someone had an injury, they'd say, would you mind taking a look at her? I'd take a look at her, give a little opinion. I'm sorry, that one's got to be seen in the office. We have to take an x-ray. And then we'd pursue on that. But I really gave a lot of my time for free, never asked for a remuneration, for stipends, for coming out there week after week to dancers, gymnastic studios. I happened to get lucky on the gymnastic end in that the coach that I volunteered, the club happened to be close to where I live, and my little daughter was taking some classes there, and I started just showing up a lot and showing him, and he happened to turn out to be one of the coaches for the United States Olympic team. And before I knew it, I was the team podiatrist for the United States Olympic gymnastics team in 1980. So that was just pure luck to be in the right place at the right time. With the NFL football team, that again came along, and I was very careful and didn't get too much surgery the first few years I was with them. We had an orthopedic surgeon that was an old-timer. Wasn't a bad guy, but he just took everything on. And then he got replaced by a very young orthopedic surgeon who the first thing he said to me, you guys do great jobs with orthotics. Stan James just wrote an article on how orthotics help runners. And I have a lot of respect for what you do. He didn't say anything about my surgical abilities, but he certainly came in understanding that we had something to offer, and we struck up a wonderful relationship. And before 3 or 4 years passed, I did everything on the foot and ankle for the Chicago Bears for about 15 years. And that was a great run. The Super Bowl was in the middle of that, and I was taking care of – I did ankle stabilizations. I did everything that was necessary to be done for them that was for the ankle or below. And then it just happened again, luck as it may have it. Jerry Reinsdorf, who is the owner or managing partner of the Chicago Bulls and the Chicago White Sox, happened to have been my first attorney when I went into practice. He incorporated me. I was the first podiatrist in the United States to incorporate because Jerry Reinsdorf was the one who said we have to change the law. Doctors weren't allowed to incorporate, and he gave speeches in Chicago. I happened to be at one of his speeches. I said, okay, I want you to incorporate me. I don't have much money but or a big practice yet, but I think it's probably the right thing to do. And then I started investing with him back in those days, and was very, very lucky guy to get. So when Jerry Reinsdorf bought the Chicago White Sox, he called up the guys that invested with him in the past, said, would you like to be an investor? I said, oh, my God, that's too big for me. He said, I promise you won't lose any money. I said, well, if you say I won't lose any money, then I'm coming along. So I became an investor in the Chicago White Sox. And, of course, then he bought the Chicago Bulls the next year. And when he made the call for the Chicago Bulls, I said, no, I'm too conservative. I can't take a chance of going with two teams. And, of course, the Bulls had a run for 6 years where the return was a lot better than it was for the Chicago White Sox. But, nevertheless, it was fun to be involved in both. So I was I worked with the Chicago Bulls as a consultant and the White Sox and the Bears all at the same time for a few years. And that was a great experience and certainly challenging. Players today often will seek third and fourth and fifth opinions. They have agents today. They want to go to the top guy in the country all the time. But many of them always stuck with you at the same time as well. And I had wonderful experiences with people like Walter Payton and Frank Thomas of the Chicago White Sox, being able to take care of them and watch them get better and nurture themselves. And, of course, both I think Thomas will eventually be a Hall of Famer in baseball, and Payton certainly was in football, and knowing you had a small part. But I think probably the biggest moment in baseball, Carlton Fisk, a very famous baseball player who his great fame was with Boston, but he spent some good years with us. I took care of him when he had plantar fasciitis, and he was very, very reticent to trust anyone. And I finally had to sit him down and give him a real man-to-man talk. And I said, look, goddammit, I'm interested in your welfare. I understand I work for the team, but I'll do whatever it is to make you better. And let's get that straight right now. Don't ever second-guess me or find somebody else to take care of you. And we made good friends. And on his retirement day, speaking from the field, I actually left the game already. First, I went down to congratulate him, but I went home. And on my way home, I was listening on the radio, and he said he'd like to thank several people. And he included me in his thanks of the people that helped him get through his career. And that was very, very kind of him. So those are the little rewards you get by just hanging out, waiting for somebody to call upon you and not being too pushy.
You touched on earlier your osteotomy that ended up being named for you over in Europe. There's been a couple of other advances that we're aware of that that you've had significant influence and made a significant impact on as far as podiatric surgery is concerned. Let's start off and talk a little bit about some of the implants around the first metatarsophalangeal joint and some of the early on results that you had in starting that particular procedure and in particular some of the success that you've had with those implants.
Well, it is very interesting. This is going back to the years of 1974-75, and then in 1976, the FDA came out with their rules and regulations of how you have to go about doing testing and so forth to get anything approved by them. Back in those early days, I was telling someone the story today, we went with an idea to Memphis, Tennessee, to a place called Richards Manufacturing, which was an orthopedic company, and had a concept of using a total joint replacement similar to those that were being put in the hip. Knees haven't even been developed at that time. And pretty much copied the same kind of a formula that they did in the hip with the head of the metatarsal and the base of the phalanx. And we had the concept. 6 weeks later, we had the prototype. And 6 weeks later, we had it in our first patient. So that's how that came about. And that's just mind-boggling that we could do something like that, to get it in that fast and without much study, without much cadaver work. But nevertheless, we did it. We had about 50 cases in or so. We were doing it on patients with intermetatarsal angles of 15 degrees and not correcting the IM angle. We were doing it on what we called sublux bunions that really had joints that were decent enough that didn't need it. Just crazy. This was the best thought at the time. After about 50, when we realized that they were just stiffening up, they weren't hurting, but the function was very, very poor. And about the same time, Mayo Clinic developed a similar implant. And Ken Johnson came up to me and said, how are you doing with your implant? And I said, not very good. They're stiffening up. He said, mine are too. And so we reported to the company. We did not think it was a good concept and took it off the market after about a year. But then we became more interested in other forms of implants and modifying some of the silastic implants with an angle toe implant, and then some influence with utilizing a hammer toe implant. And that was also before 1976. The hammer toe implant we still use today. It's a small silastic rod with a little washer in the middle, and it continues to have excellent results and not break down the way those early implants did, probably because there's very little motion, but yet there's still about 10 degrees of motion. So I consider that one of the most important implants that I have had an opportunity to be involved in. And then other implants came along, opportunities come along once you're known to make it for someone else gets you, and then into screws and all the other areas. I've always been very interested in carpentry. I got some of my best ideas at Home Depot and Ace Hardware of screws and things like that, and used many of those concepts that are used in carpentry and architecture, and came forth with those. But it's one of those things where once you get into the business, just like in acting in Hollywood, once they know you, get called for a lot of parts. And once you get known for these kind of things, companies are much more able to talk to you, and you get involved in more areas. So the networking part of it really worked out, and we were able to do these things.
Dr. Wild, you have been sort of like a pioneer with a lot of the technologies and advances in foot and ankle surgery. Heel pain still remains a very difficult thing for the podiatric surgeon to treat, but yet and still you have had some advances in the ways that you have approached it over the years. Would you mind sharing with us those particular advances that you have learned, especially in the area of shockwave therapy?
Well, we come from the generation when we first started treating heel pain, heel spurs. We did major surgery. We made 5-inch incisions. We cut off the plantar fascia completely. We took out the spur, and people were laid up for long periods of time. But that was what we did. We then got it down to doing percutaneous plantar fasciotomies. We realized all we had to do was cut the plantar fascia, and I might say I was instrumental in those early days of saying that's all we needed. You didn't need to take off the spur, and the results seemed to be similar. So that was a big important area. I have to give some credit there to Orlando Mercado from the Chicago area, who was one of the ones that was very instrumental in that as well at the same time, and we kind of worked on that together. As time went on, we became involved in shockwave therapy, and that came as a result of my son, Lowell Jr., who's in practice with me during his fellowship after his residency. He went to Europe and visited 21 of my best friends over about 4.5 months with his wife, Wendy, who's also a podiatric surgeon. And when he was in Germany, they had just started doing shockwave, and he made some contacts with the companies. And he said, if you ever come to the United States, please let us know. And one of the companies, first ones to come to the United States, did, in fact, let us know. So we got involved in clinical trials, and we were able to be involved in 3 clinical trials and get involved in shockwave. We embraced it because it was successful. And used it more and more, and today we were able to be involved with one of the lower energy machines, which we didn't have much respect for back then, but it continues to be a very successful machine as well. So I think high energy and low energy both are extremely successful in relieving heel pain, and we try to stick with things that are least invasive for our patients, try to make it as affordable as possible for our patients. That's important to us as well, and then continue on trying to find a way to eradicate all heel pain from this earth if we can. At the same time, people started exercising more, so you got more heel pain. They became more obese, so we got more heel pain. And it's a never-ending problem of trying to reach this. But again, I think that our goal should be to treat conservatively for as long as we can, for at least 2 to 3 months for sure, before we consider any type of invasive, and I consider shockwave at least semi-invasive, and we follow that tenet to this day. Conservative treatment will get 85% better. Everyone should have the ability to get better without costly operations of any kind, and if they don't, then we can always look for other avenues such as shockwave.
Well, could you give us a little bit, maybe of an update, too, on shockwave? We talk about shockwave for heel pain and plantar fasciitis and certainly for other tendinopathy, but where are we now in regards to avascular necrosis or a non-union or even an affected non-union? Where are we at right now with shockwave in regards to maybe utilizing that as a tool in treatment?
Well, there's most of this work has been done in Europe. Certainly some non-union work is being done in the United States, but probably one of my again, biggest things in my life was about 3 years ago, Maglio Ordóñez, who is a famous baseball player today, plays for the Detroit Tigers. He was with the Chicago White Sox. He injured his knee, developed a vessel injury to his knee. He was told by the team that he had a vascular necrosis of his femoral condyle, and he would just have to wait it out for a year and a half. There was no treatment that could be done to reverse this. We had known about some work that had been done in Europe. He came to me asking me if I would help him because he had heard from Frank Thomas that I knew someone in Europe that could help him, and through some contacts, we were able to get him into somebody in Austria who specialized in shockwave for avascular necrosis. Long story short, he went there secretly. He was treated. Within 3 months, he was better. The next year, he had a super year, and I think this past year, he was a second for most valuable player in the American League as a result of this. So there's very few really evidence-based studies out there. It's hard to do really blinded studies in some of these things, like infections. It's hard to blind and treat with placebo. So more and more work has to be done in these areas. I think that shockwave probably has been oversold for many of these conditions, that it's, you know, working for acne and working for everything in life. I think more looks have to be taken at it, more careful looks as we get into things like infections, avascular necrosis. There's some non-union results that come out of Europe in special centers. But again, I think this stuff has to be validated in the United States, where we have perhaps much more strict guidelines of how we go about doing this. So I really don't have a particular opinion as to where it is. I see it out there. I'm listening to it. If I find a patient that has no other alternatives, then I will continue to send them to those that are doing the most of it out in Europe, but I'm not sure where it's going to go yet.
You are an editor emeritus of the Journal of Foot and Ankle Surgery, and we'd be very interested in trying to maybe learn what you've seen in the journal over the past 20 years, hopefully positive changes in the journal, and maybe a few comments on, you know, evidence-based medicine has come into the literature so much over the past 10 years. Is there no place now for the case study? Is there no place now for the retrospective study? And maybe some of your comments on that.
I think that's a great question. I think that anecdotal medicine, which is case series or case studies, are very important. Experience can win over some things. You can't do evidence-based medicine on all things, and certainly on surgery. It's very difficult because you have to compare it to something else. Even if you do prospective studies, there are not measurement tools that are fine enough to say, is it that works, or is it something else you did that worked? So I think that anecdotal reporting for many things is still an important phase of what we do. But on the other hand, where you can do evidence-based medicine and prove it, this is most important. I'm still very discouraged with the Journal of Foot and Ankle Surgery, not because of the editorial leadership, but the number of papers that are submitted to that journal. We're seeing more and more papers in the Journal of Foot and Ankle Surgery that come from foreign sources, you know, from all over the world. It's terrific that we're getting them, but not when they're the vast majority. When I was a residency director 30 years ago, I absolutely required every one of my residents at any level that they were, as part of them finishing the year, they had to have a research project that was sufficient to be able to be publishable in a journal. and they all had to do it, and they had until April 1st to get their paper in, and if they didn't, it was no problem at all. They just all stopped doing surgery. They were on the floors. They did everything else. They just couldn't do surgery, and none of them ever missed the deadline date when they had that over them. And to this date, I don't see enough papers coming out of institutions where every one of our residents should be required as a thesis every year to do a research paper. It makes them a better podiatric surgeon. It makes them understand what that problem is, and they learn so much from it when they do it. So I think this is a big need for us to get more papers by podiatric surgeons in our journal. I think they're doing a great job. Scott Malaya is a fabulous editor, as was John Schuberth when he took over. But they need the material. They can't produce their own material. We need to get better material to them.
You commented on the fact that when you were residency director, you required your residents to submit a paper to the Journal of Foot and Ankle Surgery. A lot of residency programs have sort of gotten away from that being a requirement. Can you comment on your overall assessment on where residency training has gone and where you think it's been heading and any recommendations you might make if you had the ability to do so?
The biggest concerns that I have in residency training within the field of podiatric surgery is still emphasizing the technical aspect of surgery rather than the overall aspect of surgery, which starts with the appropriate diagnosis, the consideration of all the various things that go in it, and then a careful analysis of not only the bad results, but the good results. When we see something that's good, I want to know why it's good, what worked, what didn't work. I spend more of my time on my patients that fail in analyzing their preoperative x-rays, trying to figure out what I did wrong technically, plus the fact of what their total body situation was. So I think that residency programs need to delve into more into research, into journal clubs, and spend more time with a residency program on research. I'm very concerned about one of the board certification requirements of having to do so much cases and that cases cannot be taken out of the residency program. I think that's a mistake. What the Board of Surgery is doing is requiring new graduates to go out there and do more surgery than they should be doing so that they can get their numbers in to get board certified. Whereas if they allowed them to use cases from their residency program and then put them through a really tough oral examination, they could really find out what level they're at. But if you require 50 cases in order to become board certified, you're going to have to get those 50 cases in. You're going to have to sometimes do surgery on somebody that you might have waited just a little bit longer. And we find this with young practitioners that we take into our group. And I think that's a big mistake, and it needs to be looked at more carefully. But I think residency programs are just fabulous compared to the days when we train them. They're going places, the rotations that they have, they're putting out great people, but I don't want them to lose sight of the fact that surgery is more than just the art of surgery. It's also the science of surgery.
Well, Dr. Wild, having said that, and you talked about as far as like your view of the residency training as of now, what would you tell a young practitioner out of residency, out of fellowship, what it takes to be successful? Because your practice has endured success for a great number of years that can be a pattern and a model for some of the young practitioners.
I think, number one, you have to have a passion for the profession. When you have a passion, it's not too difficult to become successful because you really believe in it. You want to go for it. I'm always a great believer to find the greatest literature that's out there. Read everything that you can. Listen to the mentors. Listen to the people that are perhaps your outstanding speakers, the people that you can believe, and listen to them carefully. And be conservative as you can, and at the same time, try to do the best job you can for your patients. And work hard, and don't try to become famous overnight. Let it happen and try to do it in the proper way, and really try to treat your patients like you would family. That sounds corny, but if you really always use that tenet, I think that you'll be very, very successful, and you'll have the great majority will be happy. Not every one of them is going to be happy because there's always failures, but certainly the great majority will be on your side.
Although you've been president of the College of Foot and Ankle Surgeons, I believe you've been president of the Board of Podiatric Surgery, and we've really enjoyed listening to all the rest of the experiences that you've had. And so this is sort of the million-dollar question, I guess, for you. Where are we going in foot and ankle surgery over the next 5 to 10 years, or maybe even 15 years? And along with that, maybe what's the one or two biggest challenges that you're going to see, or we're going to see as foot and ankle surgeons as we progress through that time period?
That's a very interesting question. I'm going to start with the last part of the question, which I think are the challenges. The challenges are not only for podiatric surgeons, but the challenges are for all of medicine. All of medicine have to stop being sheep and start to fight back for the rights that we should have with regard to reimbursement, with regard to decision-making, and let our patients all have the benefits of the knowledge that we have and the tools that we have to treat them. And there has to be a way that this will work. Somebody was talking today that he took one of the insurance company to small claims court, and the insurance company backed down and settled with him. And he said, you know, we probably have 100,000 physicians in California. And he said, if all 100,000 took an insurance company to small claims court, that would certainly make the news. And perhaps that's a route to go someday, because we can't strike, we can't do other things. But it's a challenge. But at the same time, this is an avenue for us to become more closely aligned with our competitors, so to speak, and that's the American Orthopedic Foot and Ankle Society, on areas that might be of mutual interest, but certainly not areas to do with any level of reimbursement, because that would be collusion and we can't do anything like that. But we could talk about CPT coding. I think we're very inadequate on our CPT coding in the foot and ankle. We should have many more CPT codes that define better what we're doing. If you look at the hand codes, you see every little thing that they do is in there. I think we need the same thing, so we can honestly report. This is a way for us to become aligned with the American Orthopedic Foot and Ankle Society and try to reach mutual agreement starting on that area, and then go into the training aspect and everything else. I also think that we need to continue with the progress of what the college has done, and that is not to make it mandatory to be a member of the American Podiatric Medical Association, to be a member of the American College of Foot and Ankle Surgeons, to engage those podiatric board-certified individuals, allow them to join our organization, because there is a difference between board-certified podiatric surgeons and the rest of the profession. I don't mean to demean those that aren't, but they are what they are. They're general practitioners, and we are what we are. And we have to make that definition, have to keep it clear, and move on in our direction for what we feel is best for those of us that have become board certified, not to exclude others, let the chips fall where they may. But I think we really have to be our own people and go off in that direction. I think that I really envision podiatry and podiatric medicine as coming to a point in time where we will have joint degrees sometime. At some point in time, I think the educational level perhaps will go mandatory 3 years is what I see, and fellowships will become commonplace. I see more and more podiatrists joining orthopedic practices. I know I've been involved in over 50 podiatrists joining orthopedic practices around the country and continue to be involved in that area because I think that's a good fit sometimes for certain orthopedic practices and certain podiatric physicians. So I see it coming closer and closer, and as long as we continue to stay with our heads up high and move forward, we'll be part of the medical community in earnest.
Well, at this point, I would like to thank Dr. Weil for allowing us to spend this time with him and listening to his observations on many years of a successful podiatric practice, as well as his observations and experience along the lines of advances he's made in foot and ankle surgery. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. And please look for our next podcast, Volume 3, Number 3, for March 2009.